Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's July 29th, 2018, and welcome to episode 176 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, reminiscing about things done recently, and slow editing. So, I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined today by two retro computer roundtableists. First, in Toronto, Canada, we have Carrington Vanston. How are you?
I am fabulous.
Excellent.
Spread the word.
Noted.
People need to know.
Quelle surprise. And also in...
Ooh, that's French.
Ah, sorry. I limited the spreading of the word to just the francophones.
But, just tell those in Quebec.
Also, we have in Stockholm, Sweden, Jack Nutting. How are you?
Hello, I'm good. It's very, very hot here. Unusually hot. Which in Sweden, that means like it's 88 degrees Fahrenheit. But it's really, really hot here, so...
Isn't that the temperature at which you can travel in time?
Yes.
I think that's how that works.
If you're struck by lightning when it's 88 degrees
that's
Fahrenheit,
right.
You will go back to the 50s.
All right. So it's been a busy month or so for lots of us. And so what, like a week ago? I think about exactly a week from now, when, as I'm recording, I was heading for the airport to leaving Kansas Fest. And so... For my part, that means all of the editing was very slow, so as we're recording this, it's also the day that the previous episode got released. So, and I can also add, you cannot drive to Juneau. There are no roads to Juneau. I looked that up afterwards. But anyway, it's fresh in my mind, nobody else's, but at any rate. I don't have much of a host topic, although I am a host, but we have done a couple of things recently, and so I think the thing that we will talk about now is Kansas Fest, because Carrington and I were just at Kansas Fest, and we did actually record a big mega podcast with a bunch of podcasters that will come on our feed after this episode, but it turns out in that... Unusually, we didn't really talk much about Kansas Fest. We just talked about other things. So it's fun. It'll be interesting to listen to, but it's not going to be redundant with talking about some of the interesting, you know, talks and products and interactions and things that we saw there. So, correct?
Correct.
Hooray. So Jack was not there.
Right. By tradition,
sorry.
I was not there.
That's right.
According to time-honored tradition, I did not attend Kansas Fest. So that's fine. But, it's something that I have for years followed from a distance when it's on. It fills up my Twitter feed. It's, oh, look, that. I liked the small Atari contingent handing out some sort of literature pamphlets. Have you heard the good news about Atari?
That was very, very funny.
What was actually on those pamphlets? I'm just curious.
Oh, they were real brochures.
Were they vintage Atari brochures or something new they made up?
I think they were vintage. The one I have, I still have it, not in front of me, but it was a scanned, reprinted modern printing, but
okay.
of an original Atari spec sheet.
Nice.
So, yes, they were very funny. This was Rob McMullen and Kevin Savitz, who dressed up in suits and walked around the vendor fair, like spreading the good news about Atari.
Okay, that was my next question. It's like, what was the context? When and where are they doing this? So there's a vendor fair. It's like one particular, one certain day that this happens. Or is it kind of whenever?
It's one day. It's at the very end on the Saturday. I think it's the, or is it the Friday?
It's the Saturday.
Saturday, yeah. So on the Saturday, there is a vendor fair. People who have things to sell or to show off, set them up on tables and everybody can go down. I usually don't pick up anything. And this year, I actually bought something. I bought a bag. I got the Beagle Brothers bag.
Okay. I also did. So we will have we will match in our RCR travels.
Excellent. Excellent. We're a club.
It's part of the uniform.
I'm stuck on this Juno thing. I've been to Alaska by road. I went to Anchorage. I thought I went to Juno. I remember going to Anchorage and then a place called Portage. And then I took a road down to some place called like something point, like Anchorage Point or Happy Point. Or I don't know. It was like 30 years ago. And all that was by road. But maybe I didn't go to Juno.
Well, I think that...
I definitely went to Anchorage.
I mean, you can put your car on a ferry.
Oh, and I did. Like there's a few places where you take little ferry things, but... Maybe I didn't go to Juno.
So what is the context of this driving to Juno or not? Because I missed something.
Yeah, in the previous episode, in the previous episode there was an auction and it was in South Carolina and whatever. Something else came up about driving, and it occurred to me, like, I had this little factoid that I thought I remembered, which is that weirdly the capital of Alaska is not actually accessible by road. And I thought I knew this. And
look at him.
Carrington thought I was not correct, and I think I was correct still.
Looking on a map, I think you're correct. Looking at Haynes, and then it is boat or plane from there. So, okay. If we have listeners up in the cold.
Yeah. So, actually, we'll just get a lot of email between now and between, like, today when that episode was released and when this one is. A lot. All of the Alaskans will write. All of the retro-commuting Alaskans will write. We will get one email.
Right.
On a sealskin.
Right.
Okay, but so Kansas Fest. So apart from the Atari contingent, like, was there new stuff, say, at the vendor fair? Like, we talked about various Apple II enhancements kind of all the time. Was there anything that's sort of new that you guys have been waiting for or that surprised you?
No.
There were a couple of things that were sold at the vendor fair. I think the things that what I'm sort of most interested in, I think, are the things that were announced but not actually there. But yeah, there's one super kind of like exciting development that was basically sprung on us at Kansas Fest. I had a hint of it coming a little bit before that, but it was mostly news, which is a video card that outputs HDMI and fits in basically all of the Apple IIs except that have slots. So there's the Apple IIc does not have slots, but every other one can use it. It allows for like all of the video modes, actually even the fancier video modes that the older computers couldn't normally have supported, they can now support through this and through HDMI, which means you can capture it. It's, yeah.
Cool.
It looks beautiful.
It looks beautiful. It seems to operate magically well. It is just like an insanely great looking card. And then immediately everybody signed up on the waiting list.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is going to be a huge seller.
Yep.
It's so this is John Brooks, who basically, you know, is putting this together. He's also the one who has updated ProDOS, the operating system, most recently. So the way the card works is actually kind of interesting because it's basically just watching what the CPU is writing to memory, and it knows when those writes are going to correspond to graphics. And so it's keeping track internally of what the graphics are. So it's not actually reading any graphics off the Apple. It's just monitoring the writes from the CPU.
Right.
Which is such an insane way to go, because like you would think, okay, the way you would do a graphics card is you're just constantly polling the graphics memory and say like, well, what's there, and then dump it on screen. Like, this is just a totally weird and original way to approach this.
Yeah.
Cool.
What's cool about this, though, it does allow for the possibility of using these like super high res type graphics modes on an original, like, you know, 1977 Apple II. Mm-hmm. You just write into memory that isn't even there.
No.
Because, you know, the card can't tell that the CPU doesn't actually have access to this memory.
Right.
So you just write into nothingness and it goes on the screen.
Interesting. So how does this work with, like, I know the 80 column card was a popular thing for the Apple II. Does this work together with that, or does it let you do the 80 column mode without even having an 80 column card? Anything funky like that?
That's interesting. I think it would. I don't know. It's an interesting question. It basically depends on whether the program needs to refer to the things that are in memory. So if it's like scrolling things around, I don't know. That's a harder question than I thought it was going to be when I started talking. Because I think you could conceivably do it, but I think there would be some things that, you know, the computer would want to have access to,
right?
You know, and reading memory as well.
Yeah, but maybe so.
Anyway, yeah. So the vendor fair is on Saturday, is the answer.
Okay, that sounds really cool. The video card, does it have a name? I'm sure it does. Or do we know the name?
Yeah, the Vid HD.
Vid HD, good. And when is it supposed to be shipping? Is that known?
Soon.
Yeah, I think it's. He had one. I think he only had one. No, maybe there were a couple, because I know a couple people were beta testing it, but he doesn't know how much it's going to cost. I think that depends a bit on the demand. The demand is going to be huge, though.
Yeah.
So I thought he was aiming for this year, but yeah, it's not imminent. It's just soon.
Yeah.
Cool. What else? And there were a couple of other things announced. Like there's an Apple II GS accelerator clone that is now available. They're expensive, but they're much less expensive than the real ones. So I know that the Apple II GS is a computer that you almost never want to use unaccelerated. So.
Okay. Otherwise, talks, events. What were people most excited about? What was the buzz of the fest?
One of the things that I really dug was there was Mark Pilgrim talked about Pitch Dark, which is a new way to gather and play vintage Infocom games and now a greater bunch of text adventures on an original Apple II. And it's really amazingly cool. And it's like a collaborative thing where a bunch of people have done different stuff. And the GUI is put together with the Wii GUI that Quinn Dunkey had created and I think announced last year at Kansas Fest, which is a really nice GUI that's an 80-column one and uses mouse text. And now it's got like not just buttons you can click, but like you can just hit keys to do them. Like it's just a really advanced front end. And what this does is bundle in a Z code or Z machine interpreter and also all the game files. Cause like that's how an Infocom game works is you've got the game is actually just the data and the interpreter that is just kind of reads that and interprets it into the game. And that's why they were able to port things too much. And that interpreter now has been ported into this. And so you've got a combination of the amazing front end, the Z machine interpreter, and then all these game files. And it's not limited by the fact before it used to have to go on a floppy disk. So if you open it up and say, well, if it's now been ported to ProDOS and it can go on a hard drive or a bigger disk image, that opens up a ton of available space. So what can you do differently then? Well, one thing you can do is say, well, why don't we just have this interpreter? In fact, all the different versions of it, the, you know, version 3, version 4, version 5, put a bunch of them on there and maybe like 100 games and a front end that lets you go through them. And if we're doing that anyway, why not have it be able to like save your game and show you where in the game you are? So not only is it like you can just browse through and say, okay, I want to play, you know, A Mind Forever Voyaging. It can say, well, here are your current saves and you've saved here. Here's the current score or the time or the whatever. And the different games keep track of different things. Like one might be time-based, one might be score-based. But it'll say you're currently in this room and here is your score or time or what have you, and you can just resume back into a game. So it's like this like incredibly amazing experience as a way to say, I want all the Infocom games and I want to play them on a vintage computer. And then it says, well, since we've got all this, why don't we make it so you can pop up a high res screen? And so here's a high res graphics that show like the cover art. And isn't that like, it's like an incredible amount of stuff. It's just amazing. So it kind of melted my brain. I'd seen bits and pieces of it because it'd been talked about it ahead of time and little hints on Twitter, but I didn't really get the majesty of what it was. And it's really, really impressive, like a total game changer. So, and I'm super, because I do, you know, Eden by Agree with Kevin, I'm super into Infocom games. So this is like very much relevant to my interests.
Sure.
And I'm really excited about it. So it was announced and shown there and it's just incredible.
Yeah. Cool. I went and found the video of it while you were talking about it and didn't watch, but just sort of clicked through and saw some screen grabs.
I probably could have watched the video quicker in my rambling talk about it. But I don't even me talking about it doesn't do it justice. Like,
no.
It's really an amazing thing.
Mm. Yeah, and it actually was also a large chunk of the work behind it was done by Peter Ferry, who basically was the one who made it possible to incorporate this into ProDOS. ProDOS has large volume support. And apparently the memory was super tight on some of these.
Yeah, it was some crazy thing where they had 128K available and like the version 5 of this will use 127.75 or something. It's like, okay, let's try to get that. I mean, just insane. So yeah, it was Peter Ferry that basically created the ProDOS compatible interpreter for all these Zen Machine things. And so then the idea is, oh, well, we've got that now. Let's put, and that's what Mark Pilgrim did. Let's put that amazing front end on it and then add all these features and kind of be a driving force behind it. Say, hey, and I think he was also kind of, Peter was saying he'd get these, you know, 3 a.m. texts from Mark saying, could we do this? I guess, yes, we could and just do it. And so, and just all this stuff came together and just in a really impressive, really amazing, amazing product.
Nice. Sounds really cool.
So what else? Oh, I had a chance to play what's this called Robot Rascals, which was an interesting sort of combination of like card game and computer game. I think it's Electronic Arts. Does that sound familiar to anybody?
I got to play it at Kansas Fest too.
Oh yeah, okay, all right.
I don't know if it's Electronic Arts. I just know it's like a card game / board game / computer game.
Yeah, and that was kind of neat. I mean, that's one thing that's actually kind of cool about this whole event is that you are in this environment where you have like who else are you going to play this with in real life, right?
Right.
It takes 4 people, computer to moderate the thing, you know, cards that you play, and it was actually sort of surprisingly complex. Basically, the things you're looking for are the things that are in your hand, but a lot of the sort of like events that happen in the game cause you to switch cards with other people. So you for a long time you'll be looking for something, and then suddenly the thing you were looking for you no longer need.
Right.
And so then you have to go try to beat up somebody else to get it back and stuff.
Right.
It's quite interesting. I enjoyed it a lot.
Cool. But I feel like I recognized the name, and I went and looked at it, and I saw what it looks like, and it kind of I know I've not ever played it, but it kind of rings a bell.
I had never even heard of it before, and I got to play it as well, and I really liked it. Unfortunately, we were playing it on a 2C with one of those Night Owl monitors, like a little teeny tiny monitor, and it would benefit from a larger monitor. And also, we didn't have a joystick, so we were playing on keyboard, and the keyboard functionality is terrible. It's one of those ones where you press a key, and you just press it once, and you start moving in that direction. And if you press a different key, you'll change direction. But to stop, you press a completely other key. It was very difficult to move your little robot around because of it. So I didn't like that. But the gameplay and the mechanics of it are really interesting and really fun. Like, it holds up. I would play it again in a heartbeat.
Cool.
Anyway, there's lots of that. There's lots of gaming. We have an ongoing Dungeons & Dragons game that I got killed in, which was super fun. And so we've been going on for 3 years, which means 3 sessions. And so like every year we play for a few hours one night and just continue the adventure. That's super fun. You know, walking the hallways and just talking about Apple II stuff and vintage computers in general, and just getting to play things and going out and to an arcade with pals and looking at all the sessions. It's just like you get so immersed in the community of vintage computers and the Apple II in particular. And it's just super fun, like, to be around a bunch of people who just like get it. Like, they're your tribe, and you don't have to explain to them like, you know, like in real life, if you go to Kansas Fest, people ask you, hey, what are you doing for your vacation? Then you'll explain you're going to Kansas Fest. And they say, well, why would you do that? Like, everyone's like, that sounds awful. All the people who wouldn't ask you, why would you do that, are at Kansas Fest. So
right.
You're hanging out with people who wouldn't say, oh, why the heck would you do that? They'd say, oh, how can I go? How can I have fun? So the kind of people who would get it, who would get the appeal, they're the people you're doing it with. And it's just amazing. Like, not just from a technical standpoint. It's great to have people around that you can ask them your technical questions, or get somebody to help with something, get somebody to help retrobrite your computer, or you've got have difficulty with a card or your keyboard's not working, there'll be somebody there who can fix it. Like, so having the community of help is amazing. But more than that, it's just like being around your tribe, being around people who just like understand why you'd want to do this, why they are as interested in this as you are, maybe even more so. That is just exciting and just still a lovely thing. Like still every year, I just appreciate the heck out of it.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Agreed.
Cool. I mean, it sounds like what you're saying sounds like the distillation of everything that I've heard about it, really. That like the details of what happens from year to year are maybe not the most important thing of, yeah, this year this was announced or this year this talk happened. But it's more the community thing, the thing of being, like you said, back with your tribe, the annual gathering of the tribe sort of.
It totally is. And lots of stuff does get announced. Like it's hard to remember. Like I remember what's another one? Like Quinn had showed off a game that she's working on.
That was quite something.
Called Cats GS, which is a 60 FPS game on the GS with destructible 2D terrain, and just how she's doing about it. Like that the game is data, and it was just amazing. Like, to go to the technical details of how you do that was an eye opener for me. But just to like see the game, and it was totally cool. But then that's another example. She'd been working on it, working great, but in emulation comes to the event, and there's of course lots of actual hardware around, and that. Running on that found things that were wrong. And so there was a lot of discussions at Kansas Fest this year about like kind of what's wrong with emulators. Like some emulators are much better than others. And the state of Apple II GS emulators isn't necessarily as good as like the 8-bit ones. You, on a Mac, if you deal with Virtual 2, it's an incredibly accurate, incredibly good emulator. But emulators are always translators. And so they don't always do everything correct. But like there seemed to be like no emulator for the GS that does the vertical blank correctly. Which is remarkable. So it's how do any games work?
Right.
So you just find that kind of stuff. And so then having that's the place to find out, and that's the place for other people to dive in and work on stuff. And so that sort of thing. I mean, just from big announcements to little things and just you know, people talking about books that have come out. And the keynote, we haven't even touched on the keynote, was Roger Wagner, who I only knew as the guy who did the Assembly Lines stuff. So right. The Assembly Lines book and the Assembly Lines article, that's Roger Wagner. Mm. Turns out also Song and Dance Man.
Like,
he gave one of the most entertaining keynotes imaginable with multiple costume changes. He is incredibly interesting. Like such a dynamic speaker, such an interesting person. He has so much energy and was like so involved. And I got to like hang out with him, and he was showing me and a couple other people like hands-on, here's how the Hyperduino works. And we like wired it up together. Like he's all like, do this and press this button here and let's go together. So while I got him to sign my Assembly Lines book, the big moment was having him assemble a Hyperduino with me and show you how you would code it. Like, it's just amazing. Like, such a giving person. He just spent a ton of time talking to people. A great keynote. Like, just really, really interesting person. I enjoyed that keynote, I think, more than anyone so far. I've been to, I think, 10 of these, and I think this was my favorite keynote.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it was
nice.
Awesome. There's lots of awesome stuff. And the final of the garage giveaways. So Sean Fahey's, and with help, lots of help from James Littlejohn, their Apple II garage giveaway, where literally tons of things have been just given into the community. And this is the last year of that. So,
mm-hmm.
But not with a bang, though. A lot of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is, I guess it is, like, the community is a big part of it, but they're actual, like, significant events at each one as well. So.
Mm.
And it was awesome. Highly recommended.
So
cool.
I wanted to mention, like, so the thing about Quinn's presentation, she was basically just pushing the hardware super, super hard. I mean, like, that's in a way, that's why she found the problem with the emulators, is that, you know, she was really pushing it right to the edge, and the emulators weren't quite there. Also, Rob McMullen gave a pretty interesting kind of similar, like, pushing the code optimization talk. What he was basically doing was talking about font rendering on a screen. So the idea is like rendering screen fonts as fast as you possibly can to use them in order to make a game with them. So if you substitute game shapes with font characters, you know, then he last year had written a game which used that technique. And so that was actually really interesting. I think one of the most interesting things was that it turned out that completely unrolling the code wasn't as fast as he could get it to go. he got it to go like one step faster.
Okay.
But it was, yeah, that was really interesting because he gave like specific examples. Like, okay, here we're just going to write out and here's, you run it and here's how fast it does it. Here's how many characters on the screen you'll get and how many cycles it'll take to fill a screen. And then if we do it this way and we use a table to tell us the starting place for each line, how fast do you get? Okay, now what if we use a table to tell us every single location? What like? And so it kind of iterated through the different things and would show you like how fast does it get for each stop. And because each one of these things also takes up a lot more memory. So say, okay, now right. If we do this, you'll get this much faster, but now it's going to take this much memory. And it's about picking your trade-off. I found it very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And he's an Atari guy, so, you know.
And he's an Atari guy.
So
handing out those flyers.
Yep. I guess maybe the one other thing I wanted to just mention, which was kind of cool, was Kevin Savitz did a he presented the first Laserdisc video game, and that's so the story behind that is pretty cool, and people should watch the talk and stuff. But I mean, essentially, there was I think it's in Byte magazine, the editor of Byte got a little like basically a controller, like a serial controller for video discs, and wanted to like use it for something, and so got somebody to write an adventure game that would basically take the video disc and like play little cutscenes, you know, as things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kevin basically assembled all the stuff to recreate this, and actually then also wound up recreating it with a DVD, which is much more accessible. But
right,
so it was pretty cool to see this. You know, it was pre-Dragon's Lair. Little use of computer generated, computer controlled video.
It's cooler than even it sounds, because yeah. Like imagine like a lot of text adventure games. If you're playing Mask of the Sun, I bring that up because I really, really want to play that game. Mm-hmm. So you're in a certain room and there'll be like a drawing on the top. So it's a graphical thing. So the top of the screen is like a drawing and the bottom of the screen you type, you know, take wrench or whatever. This instead would be split screen. So the one monitor you're typing your text on and a whole other monitor, the one attached to the Laserdisc player or DVD player, is showing you the images. But instead of just being little, roughly drawn images, they are either stills or clips from a movie. So you enter a room and here's the room and all the machinery going. And you type look, suddenly it cuts to a little clip of a person holding up binoculars. And like, it's just amazing. It's like suddenly, like say your Apple II has, you know, DVD quality video.
Yeah.
It's super fun and actually a fun game. I really like enjoyed playing through it. And I got very excited about the idea, because I'm like, oh my goodness, you could just write stuff and control it, but Laserdiscs are hard to get to. And then when Kevin said in his session that the same brand, I think it was Philips, mm-hmm. their DVD players, they have a whole line that have a serial card or serial port, and they use the exact same protocol, so it'll just work. And so of course I'm thinking, oh my goodness, that's amazing. That opens up so much easier. But it turns out there's like one DVD player they made with this thing, and it is like the size of a desk. So that was disappointing, because I had this image of like a little tiny one
right.
sitting beside an Apple II, but it's a very, very large thing.
Okay.
So that's a little disappointing, but still more accessible. And I've already checked eBay, and these things are available. So I am sorely tempted to pick one up and do something for next year.
So this game that he was showing then, was this a commercial product back in the day?
It was a type-in from the magazine.
Oh, okay.
And so, but based on an actual movie, a movie called Roller Coaster. So there's one of those 1977 disaster movies, sure. like a person's putting a bomb on a roller coaster. And so the game is somebody has placed a bomb on a roller coaster, and you've got to find it and defuse it, like you're a detective. And the nice thing is, well, funny thing, every time you fail in some way, the bomb will explode. You'll see the video of the roller coaster falling off in destruction. And then they'll say, it is 1 year later. The bomber's back at it. You have another attempt. I destroyed this thing like 10 times before I was able to solve the game. That was fun.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's basically, and the nature of the video disc back then, or laser discs, the movie would be spread over multiple discs.
Right.
And Kevin talked about how there was a couple of different protocols of those. And so there's only a particular one that lets you go to still frames and do like point to point, like just play this, go to this point and play till this point. And so they've got to be discs in that protocol. But they only can take so many minutes of video per side, so it's multiple sides. Mm. So when he made this video, it's got to only use parts from side one of the movie.
Right.
So this is what's accessible. You have this half an hour of the movie, make a game.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool that it was a type-in game, and it required, you know, this set of like 9 possible video disc players and this video disc and the controller card. It's not impossible that Kevin is like the second person in the world to set this up.
I should do it.
Yeah. There's a person who wrote it, and then him, and then he had me play it, and that may be the extent of people who have played this game ever.
Yeah.
We have a brief mini episode of Eaten by a Groove that's coming out probably tonight about this. I asked him a couple of questions about it, so we did like a little mini one, and then we'll embed his talk or something. So.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, so we can stop talking about that here because there's another place to listen to it. But
I like scooping all podcasts, including my own.
Yeah. Well, I can near guarantee this is not coming out tonight.
But anyway, short answer is Kansas Fest is really awesome and people should go because it will not last forever.
Right.
I've been saying that for 10 years, but it's still true.
Yeah. But it will last to next year. So there's one more. There's at least one more you can go to.
Yeah. And you should.
Cool.
All right.
So what else do we got?
Anything else that we should say about that? Probably not. I can't see the time, but we've talked a lot about this.
We've talked a lot. I want to know about you guys together at Carlton, and you looked at stuff, according to our notes. Mm, what stuff
true.
Did you look at?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, we went and visited with the guy who's the head of the math and computer science, like, tech stuff. His name is Mike Tai. He worked there when we were both students there. And I used to have a student job doing sysadmin stuff working for Mike. And Paul, you were doing stuff for some professors and things. So we were both like, we both knew Mike really well. And so we sat down and talked to him for a while. And he's like, hey, come and look at some stuff. And since the time we were there, there's a whole new math computer science building. And so he took us down to the basement where like they had tucked away some old things. What did we look at? Like, I know we looked at the old PDP-8E that we've talked about a number of times. That was not in the basement. That was up in a room. They had taken that out of the rack and had just that by itself. But down in the basement, we did see the rack it used to be in, which included the funky old paper tape drive and stuff, which is all non-functioning but cool. And he kind of pointed out some other things that I didn't really know what all of them necessarily were. I think you took a few pictures. I took a couple pictures as well.
I intended to take more pictures than I did. But yeah, it was basically we were just brought down, you know, to like this basement storage room where they had just like, I think there was a couple of old, I'm pretty sure there's like a next monitor in there.
Mm.
And, you know, a couple of VT100 type terminals from the
right.
time and like all this stuff. I'm just thinking, oh, well, you know, these are things that I kind of look for.
Right.
but also, you know, hearing essentially whenever you talk to places like this, you just hear, oh yeah, you know, last year we just recycled, you know, all those things that you're just buying on eBay. And
right.
It's a little depressing to think about. Like, I mean, they had, I think the next lab had, I don't know, it was probably like 4 cubes and a couple of the next stations and things. And, you know, those would all be cool to have and very expensive to buy now.
Right.
I'm sure they just got trashed. But
which is kind of interesting, considering how much colleges are frequently, you know, at least as an alumni, they're always asking us for money. They always seem to be strapped for cash.
Yeah, just know? eBay those
there
cubes.
Things, they could sell those things instead of throwing them away.
I like just like that phrase, eBay those cubes.
Yeah. But I mean, it's possible that I know businesses often are pretty paranoid about recycling, you know, versus destroying. So, so if there's anything that has any kind of recorded data on it, they will drill it with a metal drill or whatever to make sure that like no emailed announcements from the poli sci department get out into the wild.
Wouldn't want to get those out there.
But yeah, I'm trying to think what else there was. I remember being pretty impressed by that room. But just, you know, having a chance to kind of like see that they hadn't thrown everything away, that, you know, that there was a place. And I think Mike himself, I think he has a tiny bit of nostalgia. It's only a tiny bit.
Yeah.
I think he would throw those things away if he could.
I'm sure he will eventually. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah.
I can't remember the details of too much. Well, we didn't. Then, of course, we had the podcast we recorded with Michael Current, which is great. And that's all the sort of retro-y stuff that went on there.
As we left that, I remember thinking, oh, there'd be plenty of stuff to talk about. But it's true that, you know, my memory's poor enough that I've already forgotten most of it.
Yeah. It's like, what? We saw some old computers. I don't remember.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, good enough.
Yeah, it was good. But I think and one of the biggest impressions I had also was, just like you said, the kind of feeling of, oh, that's a bummer. They just throw away stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember that stuff. Yeah, we threw that away.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so maybe we can move away from what was our ostensible topic here.
Sure.
And we will skip over listener feedback this time and move straight to the items of interest and news that we have collected together. And Carrington, you have the first one. I don't know what this is, but
it is a weird, weird thing that actually came out quite a few months ago, October, I believe, and it relates to the ThinkPad. So there was the IBM ThinkPad, the notebook, or sub-notebook, and then became a Lenovo thing. And the people who loved them, loved them. I was not one of those people, but some people really dug them. Like, people will say that little red track nubbin thingy in the keyboard is like the greatest way to do anything ever.
Right.
I don't understand that thinking at all. It's like using a joystick to guide your mouse around. I don't get it. But the people who got it really got it. And I think it's like BlackBerry users who loved it and said, like, nothing has ever been as good as my BlackBerry. Some people say that about their ThinkPad. It's like, nothing was ever as good as my ThinkPad. Like, the form factor, the size, they like the little track nipple thing. And it's like, just, it was the laptop for them. And that is now like a nostalgia thing. I don't share it. I don't get it, but I acknowledge that it's a thing. Well, last year, Lenovo put out a retro ThinkPad for the 25th anniversary, and I think it was based on the T470 model. Tells me nothing, because honestly, when I looked at the Lenovo site right now, all ThinkPads look retro to me. I'm looking at these, I'm like, I can't tell which one is supposed to be the retro one. They all look the same. But to the discerning eye, some of these are more retro than others. So that's a thing. And that's existed, I think, since September, October, or something like that of last year. Well, around that same time, some people said, like, they're really into the retro ThinkPad, but they want an actual vintage ThinkPad. Like, they want something with a 4:3 aspect ratio screen, which the new ones don't have. They want like this sub A4 footprint, they call it. And they just like want the old model, like that physical old one, but they want it run much faster and much more modern. Well, 51NB.com is a place where you can go to buy newly made motherboards for those retro ThinkPads. And this blew my mind that this is a thing that exists. Huh. So it does exist. So if you want your old ThinkPad, but you just want to pop in a whole brand new, like, Intel i5 or even i7 motherboard, depending on the model of ThinkPad you're going into, then this is a site you can go to and buy them. It's crazy to me. Now, if you go to 51NB.com, there's all the specs and all the information, and you can say, okay, I want to put a motherboard in my, like in this case, the T70 motherboard. So here you go. It'll go into, I guess, a T70. But when you click on learn more, it goes to sites that are strictly in Chinese. So you're on your own from there. I'm not sure how you get to, I want this, to, I've got this. People online are buying them and they seem happy with them. One of the issues with this, of course, or I say of course, but when I'm reading the forums, people get these and are very happy with them. But one of the reasons it seems that people love the old ThinkPads, where they were kind of like Nokia phones, like they're kind of indestructible laptop. You've got this notebook, you really beat on it, and it just works great. And so that's an issue here. People are saying, like, how will the reliability of this be? You're putting in this new limited run, kind of handmade, custom bespoke motherboard. Like, how, what's the kind of service you'd have? But I figure, well, worst case happens, if it just dies, you'd pop back your original motherboard in again, unless it catches on fire or something. But site says they have sold something 2189. So over 2100 of these motherboards have been sold already. They've been for sale since October of 2017. And it blew my mind that this exists. Like, this, because I'm out of the ThinkPad oeuvre. I don't know what you'd call it. Like, I'm just like, I've got nothing to do with that whole thing. I was never a Windows user. I was never a ThinkPad user. Like, I knew them, but I have no nostalgia for one, and I never had one. So I have been out of that completely. So this passed my radar entirely. I knew people liked them, but I did not know there are new motherboards available that you can stick in old laptops. And I think that's unique. I don't think there's anybody doing this for like old Apple laptops. You can't get yourself a Duo 2100 and get a new motherboard. So pretty cool that they're doing this. And that's what I got.
That is pretty cool. I'm not either in the ThinkPad sphere, but like I know some people who are.
Sphere is a better word. That's what I was saying.
I know some people who are deep into that, and also not Windows users. They're like Linux and OpenBSD and whatever, but like just like to have that. Like there's something about the, I don't know, I guess probably, you know, there are probably decent drivers for it. It's a limited set of hardware. It's, you know, that I guess has good support for various Unixes.
I always thought they were a good looking laptop because it's all black. Like I never got that little track nipple thingy,
right?
But everything about it, like being a good looking black super thin super light laptop,
right.
I get the appeal of that. Like the sub notebook is an appealing form factor.
Yeah, it's a nice form factor. It's a nice design overall. So I know a few people who have been into this in the past few years who are probably interested in that. But
it's kind of weird because you can buy like a small actual ThinkPad right now. For they're not expensive laptops, and you get one right now with an i7, and so I guess there's the hipsterness of like it'll be a vintage form factor and a 4x3, so it'll look like you're rocking a 1990s laptop for people that look carefully. But again, like I can't tell them apart. I don't know what to say now, like which one's the retro one? They all look the same, but I guess it'll be a 4x3 monitor. So there's that. But I don't know. Other than that, I don't like, because it's not going to be a retro laptop anymore. You stuck a new motherboard in it. So I don't know. It's a thing, but it's a thing that exists.
Yeah. And you're right that there certainly doesn't seem to be anything like that for like a Mac laptop. But I'm just thinking.
Even anything else? Are there ones where you can say like, if you really like your 1993 Dell, here's a new thing you could do.
Yeah.
Laptops are all sealed up, aren't they? I don't know. I'm a Mac user. I don't understand computers.
I know. Every once in a while, I do pull out the Duo 2300 that I have. And
are you surprised at how heavy they are? Last time I touched a Duo, I was like, wow, I used to think these were tiny and light. This is massively heavy.
Right. And it's a little screen. I am surprised every time about just how little fits on that screen.
Is and how little the screen is.
Yeah.
It's the Duo Osborne.
Yeah. Anyway. Oh, cool.
So we will have a link both to these 51NB motherboards in case you're looking for one, and we'll also have a link to the ThinkPad or the announcement of the 25th anniversary model. I'm not linking directly to the 25th anniversary model because, like I said, I can't tell which one it is. But the Verve has an announcement about it, and then you can take it from there.
Excellent. Okay, so I have the thing that I have here is it is a MITS Altair in-browser simulator at s2js.com. And I believe, so I put this in without having fully explored it. So I believe this is actually relatively new. Like, I don't think this has existed for very long. But so there's a relatively large site that sort of describes the history of the Altair and, you know, some stuff about how you program it. And, you know, it's a Intel 8080. It has 78 instructions and a link to the programming manual and stuff like that. But the main thing is that it has a simulator. It is written entirely in JavaScript, and so it runs in the browser, and you can just sort of use it with the original Altair monitor next to you as you do. And so it's, you know, it shows you the front panel, and you can click on the little switches to set them up. Let's see, I'll turn it on. Little lights come up, and I think it's making noise. Yes, it has sound effects as well. You can hear a fan when you turn it on. So that's about as far as I've got, but I think I believe that it is relatively accurate. You know, so if you really want to get the real experience, it's pretty close. I mean, you're not actually flipping switches, but anyway, whatever. I thought it was kind of interesting.
Cool.
So I expect everybody will spend much of the time between now and the next episode playing with this.
Gee.
It does look like fun.
Does it? Because, like, I had an Altair as a kit thing as a kid. I think, in fact, I'm pretty sure this is the first computer, quote-unquote computer, I ever owned. A neighbor had one as a kit and almost completed it and didn't, and then it got passed to me. And as a kid, I thought, this isn't a real computer. I've seen computers in movies. This is just like, I don't understand. I couldn't get my head around it at all. So I needed the computers, home computers, to move into the complete, like the Apple II idea of, you know, keyboard, monitor, basic, for me to understand that it was a computer.
Yeah. I mean,
this has all the appeal of like an elevator. The switches and there's buttons, and hopefully it does something you're intending, but like, that's it.
So on the site, it says the Intel 8080 is a Turing complete machine, so it can do anything that any computer can do. So
that is not true.
In reality, here are a couple of sample goals. You can write a program that adds two numbers, say 3 and 7, and displays the results on the LEDs. But yeah, I mean, I think that's probably about as far as I would really take this. I think I might kind of like the experience of setting something like that up, that, you know, I actually toggle in something that adds a couple of numbers, and that, my guess is that's probably about as far as I will ever take this. But anyway, it's kind of cool that it exists and that you could do this if
it
you
is.
Wanted.
And if you're going to do an emulator of this, this is the way to do it, because you're seeing the blinking lights and you've got the switch. And I do like the fact I've launched the emulator now too. And I like the fact that we turn it on, you hear a hum and a fan, and the switches are making real click noises. So yeah. That's a pretty good implementation.
Yep. All right.
The little touches.
Yep.
It is the little touches. But it's not a real one until you end up having to like put tape on your fingers because they're all blistered up from using this.
Right.
I never got to that point.
Okay. I guess we can move on to Myst.
Myst. That one's mine. So this is an article on Medium about the two histories of Myst. I don't know why it's presented this way, but it is. I've always been very interested in Myst, the game. I loved it back in the day, and I have ideas in my mind of replaying it, but I never seem to get around to it. And so there's a Myst 25th anniversary Kickstarter, seemed to raise a whole bunch of money last year. And this article, which is more recent though, just came out, is about the history of Myst, the game, in the context of gaming, and is divided into two sections. And it's a very long article, but it's a good one. So the first is kind of talking about Myst as an incredibly popular game that was out of step with what like real gamers called a game at the time, because Myst was released, I guess, in 1993. So that's the same as, let's say, Doom, I think, is 92 or 93. And so they represent very different extremes of gaming. And so you've got like the Doom gamer saying like, this is what a real game is. You run around and you shoot things. You got giblets everywhere and blah, blah, blah. And then you got Myst people going, well, that's fun, but I'm listening to this water as I click these moving pipes. And it's just a very different thing. And so the first half of this article, the first history of Myst, is talking about that, like talking about it in the context of being sort of looked down upon by real gamers, looked down upon by gaming magazines, everybody talking about how can this be that popular, and yet it continues to outsell everything over and over and over again. And so they'll put out a version of Quake, and Quake will be like years later, and then Myst is selling better than Quake still. it's such a like massive juggernaut of sales and popularity. And so it talks about how people saying like, oh, this isn't a real adventure game, and you know, just this is not real puzzles, and just all this gatekeeping that goes on. Well, Myst just quietly sells 800 billion trillion copies to every person on earth, and just how the people liked it, really liked it. I was one of the people who really liked it. So I say it was awesome. So it talks about the release of it and the computers it ran on, and how it was kind of denigrated by a lot of the you know, the hardcore gamers and people really interested in games and gaming journalists and all of that. And yet the general public were just, oh, this is really fun. I will continue to stay up all night and play it. Then the second history of Myst, the second half of the article really, talks about it in terms of not like, it's like what it spawns and how it's kind of not considered a real adventure game, and like it's kind of out of step with things, and like and its persistence and its influence and stuff. And so I found the second half a little less interesting, although it does keep coming back to the idea of it not being like a real game and stuff. But the first half of the article is a little more interesting, I think, than the second half. And it's a long read, but if you're interested in kind of the history of gaming, it's a deep dive into Myst and its contemporaries and its influence and the way it's viewed kind of at the time by contemporary gaming journalists. I've had a really interesting read. Like it's a big, long, deep dive into a single game from, you know, 2.5 decades ago.
Huh.
Did either of you read this article?
No, go ahead. Did you?
No, I did not. Okay. And sadly, I've never played Myst. I've known about Myst for so long, and I've never played it. One of these days, I'm going to grab it and play it.
I would recommend it. One of the bad things, unfortunately, for modern players is it's been redone a few times. Mm. So there's real Myst and more ultra-real Myst and 3D Myst. And I don't even know which is the one you're supposed to recommend. Probably a listener will listen and go, do this. But often on like if you're on GOG, on Good Old Games, GOG.com, they'll sell all the various versions. And so with something like this, it's kind of worth looking at the reviews, because people will say, well, okay, this version is okay, but if you get the 3D time traveling real Myst, don't get that version because it doesn't have this. And like Myst was basically a HyperCard game. So it was really just pictures, little bit of QuickTime movies and a little bit of audio and a tiny bit of motion as you solve puzzles, and you would click on things to just jump from one location to the next. So I guess there's versions of Myst that re-render it to higher resolution. There's versions of it that redid it into 3D that I guess you walk from location to the next, but you're still stuck in those single locations. Mm. And I guess there's combinations of those. And then there were sequels to Myst, Riven, and et cetera. But I don't know, like I want to replay it, and I don't know which is the one you should replay, because if there is a version of Myst that's literally the original game, it's just with higher resolution, that would give me just as good of an experience. Like I would feel that's amply retro. So that's probably the version I'd want to play. I just don't know which version that is.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think it is known, you know, sort of how the rendering was done. And, you know, I think they recruited a Cray and stuff like that to actually set up the original graphics, even though of course they were, you know, like if we look at them now, they seem kind of small. But I assume they still have the models that they could re-render on a fancier machine
now.
Yeah, right, exactly. I have played, I think it's real Myst. I've tried to play that a little bit, and I find it super hard to control. You know, like, it's not supposed to be part of the game that you just, like, keep walking into the like, side of a cliff, unable to move.
No. The original game was just, you know, you're looking at a picture, and if you click the top of the cliff, then it just jumps you to the top. Like you just, they're just hot spots that you click on to move around. It's like a HyperCard game or a hypertext game.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting how it, I mean, I saw that there was, you know, as I was skimming through this, there's some mention of some other games that were like it at the time, you know, like it was first, but then other ones jumped in. Like, so they mentioned Obsidian, which jumped out at me partly because I had that and played it, and I think I kind of liked it. And also it was on in the garage giveaway, you know, pool table pile.
Oh, right. Yes. I remember them talking about how Obsidian, which is a Myst-like game, sold pretty well. I think they said like it was like 4 million sales or whatever.
But still got clobbered by Myst.
But Myst in that same period sold like 130 million. It's just like, it was just like this insane juggernaut of sales. Yeah. So of course there were versions or knockoffs or like whatever.
Yeah.
But that kind of game, the whole here's a picture, solve some puzzles, click to move elsewhere, was then a whole genre or maybe a subgenre of adventure games that just hung on for ages.
Mm-hmm. But there's something they did something right in Myst. It's not super clear, you know, like something about the atmosphere, the you know, quality of the puzzles. Some of those puzzles are irritating. I mean, but maybe that's part of it too, is that they're solvable, but they're irritating. You know,
but the atmosphere is really great. There's a whole genre of games now, which I think are called walkers, where basically it's like you're in a world, everyone's gone, walk around, listen to the breeze, solve some puzzles. Like, and I like those kind of games. It like kind of captures a post-apocalyptic feel, except just without zombies or whatever. You just like walk around and I really like that type of game. And Myst is in a sense one of those, because while you're not walking around, you're just kind of looking at a thing. Often you'll be like standing on a cliffside and here's a couple of wind chimes that you can hit, and that's part of a game. But it's also just you're kind of standing there and you hear this the surf and there's wind chimes and you're all alone on this this weird looking island. So it kind of captured that feeling as well. And like that appeals to me even in modern games. So I think it's like one of my favorite Apple II games that I've talked about on previous episodes. In fact, I keep harping about is the original Portal game in Apple, which is not the more recent Portal game, but the Portal for the Apple II, which is essentially one of those. Like, it's you and everyone is gone. And where did they go? But in that case, it's just you typing on a computer, interacting with essentially a version of the internet. But I've always liked that, like that kind of thing that everyone's gone, solve some puzzles. Like, cause maybe that's really just what I'm looking for in my life. Everyone leave me alone. I want to solve some puzzles.
The puzzles are also fairly, they seem, mostly fair. I mean, like, you know, even if they're irritating, you can tell, like, you can see what you're supposed to do.
I remember it being a tough game, but I also remember solving it without having to, like, cheat like crazy. That's at least my memory of it. But again, you know, 2.5 decades ago, maybe I'm misremembering how much I cheated.
Right. But there wasn't much of an internet then, so cheating was harder.
There were books. I'm sure there were missed cheat books.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Okay, let's see. I think I will move to the next thing. There's a documentary coming out about a company called General Magic, and you may well have heard about this on other podcasts, but it's kind of news. But General Magic is a company that took sort of ex-Apple people, so it's not an Apple spinoff, but it had a lot of people who were working at Apple. So the company's founders include Mark Porat, I don't know, Andy Hertzfeld, Bill Atkinson, who you will know from History of the Mac. And they wanted to sort of create next generation computing. They're sort of notable for having envisioned, let's see, it says in the Fast Company article, it says envisioning the major components of the mobile computing experience that we all know today. They created this little, the example here is a Sony Magic Link, which is a little stylus-driven computer. It anticipated a lot of the mobile stuff that I think was I think it predated the Newton even. Does that sound right? You guys know this?
I think so, yes. I've heard of General Magic. In fact, I think we've talked about General Magic before in some context.
Yeah, we may have. It may have been in the announcements about this documentary. But at any rate, there's going to be a documentary. So I could stop talking now about what they are because you can just watch the documentary. That will tell you what they are. But there's a site, General Magic, the movie, .com that sort of talks about it. And I think it's done. I mean, like, I think it's premiered already. There's a trailer. You can watch the trailer. And I'm quite looking forward to seeing this when it is available. I don't believe it is available, but I think it is soon to be available. The Silicon Valley premiere was, whenever this article was published, July 26th. So quite recently. So, you know, go see it when you can, however you can. And if you go to the GeneralMagicTheMovie.com site, you will presumably be able to find out.
I'm going to watch it on my Newton.
Yeah.
I think this is one of those things that somehow, even though I was deep in computers at the time, all through the 90s, this just was never on my radar. Like, I never heard about General Magic, I feel like, until many years later. I've never heard much about it, really. Like, I know they had a lot of things in advance of what others were doing, but it seems like there's never really a product, as I recall. Or I don't know if so, it was a very limited product and very sort of not widely available kind of thing. I don't know. I'm curious to watch the documentary because I don't know enough about it.
Yeah, so in the timeline, it says 1994, General Magic ships one of the first handheld wireless personal communicators, what we today would call a smartphone. And that's pretty old. That's a long time ago.
Definitely.
There are various places where stories like this happen, where, you know, there was a company that had a thing that's just like something that came much later and blew up, you know.
Right.
And the question is always, like, what was not ready? Like, right. why are we not 10 years further along?
I just found a very good or interesting article from Mac Tech magazine. I used to like them quite a bit. From November of 05? Volume 11, number 5. That makes a lot more sense. Like, why so late? Called Making Magic, A Developer's Introduction to General Magic and Magic Cap. So I'll throw that in the the show docs as well. So if somebody's interested in developing for this and their Magic Cap OS, yeah. We can hook you up.
I wonder how many of these exist. I mean, like there was a product released, and I think you can, you know, get them on eBay occasionally. A new thing to collect, I guess.
Get them all.
Just what I need. But small, at least, that's the good thing.
Did you pick up anything at for the garage sale giveaway? Your collections?
All right, so the way the garage giveaway worked is that there's sort of a time at which everybody can start going and looking for things. And I've always thought this is possibly a little rough on the aging crowd. You know, this works better for kind of like a little bit more youthful group, you know, the rush for the table. There were a couple of things that I wanted to get. It was sort of like a binder full of sales material from like Apple II dealers, I think, or something. It was pretty early kind of inside tech documentation. I was not the only one who was interested in that, and I was not the first one to get there. So the other thing I picked up was a couple of these. They're sort of like Ethernet bridges that allow you to plug in older style Macs into modern Ethernet. So,
like an Etherwave type thing?
Yeah, essentially. So, like, you can use, there are certain Macs that you can use to actually sort of create that bridge, you know, put the computer in the middle and it can plug into both AppleTalk and Ethernet. But there are also these little sort of like Stingray shaped things that you can get. And I picked up a couple of those and thought, all right, well, that's cool. And then I went around and looked at some more stuff at the garage giveaway. And at some point, you know, an hour later, I realized, oh, I don't know where I put those things. So I picked them up, but then somebody else also picked them up because I don't have them now. But they're,
oh, well.
So they're cool. And I have a couple already. I sort of, they were my consolation prize for not getting the notebook. But oh. there was a Lisa mouse there too.
Oh, I don't know if I would have even recognized that.
Yeah, that's Ian Baranowski was going to try to get that, and so I didn't try to get that, but he also didn't get that. I think a different Ian got that, actually. But at any rate.
Release the Ians.
Yes. But it's interesting in a way because those are very sought after. On eBay, they are worth a lot.
I think if there was a pile of mice, there's no way I would have recognized that one of them was a Lisa mouse. What is the defining characteristic? How would one spot a Lisa mouse?
They're you know, sort of boxy. What's sort of special about them is that they have a very thin mouse button. So it's a kind of a thin rectangle up toward the top. The early Mac mice and the 2C mice had a thicker, a more square mouse button.
But okay, the Lisa mouse has a thinner
thin
mouse
one.
Button.
Yep.
Grab yourself an eBay find.
Yep. Anyway, how did we get there? I don't know. I forget how.
Collecting stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yes, right. Otherwise, yeah, I came back with a couple of books that I want to scan and a bunch of discs that I want to mostly scan the labels of because I think they've been imaged, but I'll get to them at some point. Did you take anything? I suppose you didn't.
I did not.
Yeah.
Every year, all I do is I take magazines from there, read them, and then put them back.
Right.
I use it as a reading library while I'm at Kansas Fest.
And sort of look up into the corner whistling while holding out your foot to trip with the people who are rushing the table.
Yeah, the only thing that was there that I would have been interested in, there was a Might and Magic, like the first game, totally still sealed, an Apple II Might and Magic still sealed. I would have liked to grab that, and I would have unshrink-wrapped that thing so fast.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. And I snuck, the last couple of years, I've been sneaking things into the garage giveaway. So this year, I brought a Zork, and a Zork 1 and a Zork 2, and those both got inserted. We had reviewed them on Eaten by a Grew, and I was done with them, so I smuggled them into the... So I was negative two items.
Yeah.
I don't know who got them, but they got by somebody.
You guys mentioned before this garage sale, and it's going to be the last, or this was the last one. Why was it the last mm-hmm. one? Is it a nightmare for somebody to
no,
deal with this
run
thing,
out
or?
Of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think all the stuff has been given.
Basically, all the stuff was collected either by people donating their collections or from saving, you know, saving a, like a school lab or whatever has, is closing down and there's a chance to get the stuff. So pretty much all the stuff that, that is involved in the garage giveaway was not bought for that purpose. It was just, it was sort of given to the, it was either rescued or given and then stored in a storage space. It was originally a garage, but that got bigger. And so the kind of, the idea behind it is that what, you know, since the stuff came into that collection for free, it's going out for free. And the storage space is being emptied and it's a, you know, expense to pay for the storage space and to go out and get the stuff and things like that. And so it's been winding down for a couple of years and this, I think the space is actually empty now.
And Sean was saying he's now down to things from his own personal collection, which are like the really valuable things.
Right.
And he said, well, next year he'll probably start maybe bringing some of those to set out. And I said, well, don't just set them out for free. That's crazy. Like, do a silent auction. Like, if you don't go to the big effort of selling things, set everything out and have a sign-up sheet in front of it and just let it run for 24 hours as a silent auction and you'll recoup some of the money. Because doing the garage giveaway, well, it's been a giveaway, has actually cost him tons of money because he's rented vehicles and he's gone across the country to pick up collections. Like, so it's in the hole quite a bit as a venture.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping next year if he comes, we could do like, just set it up as the same sort of thing, but do it as an auction instead of just a giveaway. It meant fewer items, but everything available and he can recoup some money. So I'm hoping that's what he does.
Yeah. This particular event has been kind of centered on this one person's, you know, sort of gathering and holding of these things. But I think there's going to forever be people who have more stuff than they need or realizing, you know, someone else could use these things that are sitting on their shelves. Mm-hmm. As I'm looking around, I can identify with that. The second through seventh of everything that I have.
But logistically, like the magic that Sean did was him and James Littlejohn using the big green bus and additional helpers to gather all this stuff and bring it in en masse. So imagine, Paul, if you wanted to get rid of like 100 items from your collection, what a pain it would be to get them from your office to Kansas. Even if you want to give them away, logistically, it's a pain. So the magic of what they did was like organize all of this and get the big bus and like, and actually get it done. And that's the real achievement. It was able to bring literally tons of stuff over these years.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It is amazing. So I do think there's going to be some smaller scale, you know, kind of like grab bag stuff available, but it's the organization that was behind it is closed it down. So
yep. And also they were cleaning up after it. So they would bring tons of stuff. Everybody would pick through it, but there's always some leftover things, basically garbage or things that people don't want. And nothing gets left there. So if a bunch of people bring their own stuff and just dump it in the lobby, if nobody takes it, they still have to take responsibility for packing it up. It's like, so there was a lot of work involved in doing this. So I really applaud all the effort that went in. It's amazing. I don't know if everybody realizes like how much work, not just money, but like work went into doing this.
Right. So yes, that's what that was. And why it ended at some point.
Right.
But, and we'll see. I mean, like, there was a, the people from what, Ultimate Micro, Reactive Micro, I can never quite keep them straight, but, there's another couple of people who are going to try to do some kind of organization of something, but it's not going to be quite the same, I don't think. So, but you know, some sort of way of getting, collecting things together and getting them distributed, stuff like this. But all right, are we out of topics?
We are.
I think we are.
Do you have a commercial for us? Do we have a sponsor?
I think we do.
Device. What a hard-working bunch. And you're working harder than most. I've seen bigger screens on a calculator. Now, this is a nifty screen, but objects may shift during flight. And you're working too hard because, frankly, your hands are just designed wrong. Ooh, an IBM ThinkPad. See, now this is what it's like to fly first class.
And we're back. All right, so moving right along here, we have the host's retro computing gift idea. And this time we will pick something that's kind of on theme for the podcast and something that is quite expensive, in fact. But they're retro AirPods. They're you know, these little the little wireless AirPods that you can get for like the iPhone. But the case has been painted to have like little Apple II-esque vents, and there's a little six color circle. It's not an actual Apple, because I think probably that wouldn't have been allowed. And the actual earpods themselves are, and the case are painted in a kind of like off-white to suggest like an, you know, early Apple II color. I don't know actually if it is. I don't know what that is the same color as now that I'm looking at that, but it's definitely not the, you know, iPhone white.
Right. It's something else.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. And it's ships in 3 to 4 weeks if you add it to your cart at $399.
Very expensive.
Yeah.
I just lost my AirPods. I'm disappointed. Actually, at Kansas Fest, I lost them.
Oh, really?
Yep. So I like them enough that I will go get another pair.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that always seemed like it is the risk of these things, is that...
Well, I didn't lose the... I had them in their little container, and I lost the whole container. Like, I got them as a set.
Oh, okay.
I think they just fell out of my pocket.
Yeah, that's the problem with, you know, increasing miniaturization. In fact, actually, there was something on the CC Tech email list or something where someone was pointing out that this move to like mini SD cards or whatever, or micro SD or whatever they are, is
yeah, because SD cards were so large and cumbersome, had to do something about that.
Well, I mean, like now they're at the point where you can lose them. You drop it on the carpet and you can't find it anymore.
Well, because it takes a long time for it to fall.
Yeah, right.
It just wafts around your room.
Have a little bit of extra time to grab it.
A new gossamer SD card.
But
see, the miniaturization with the AirPods, they're until they get so small you can just like leave them in 24/7. Just like stick them down the ear canal and go, well, they're there to stay. That's small enough. Till then I say keep shrinking.
Well, and I think actually, you know, with these things, all these wireless things, the space needs to be taken up by battery. You know, like if you have something super small, like I've been kind of enamored recently with wireless headphones generally. I haven't gotten all the way to the ones that are completely separate like this, but you know, I have many of them by now, and it, you know, like the nice convenient small ones, they last like an hour and then the battery's out. Yeah.
These things were crazy. The AirPods, I was remarkably happy with them. But I think some people, Apple's earbuds don't stay in. Mm. And if that's the case, probably these wouldn't stay in either, because they're exactly the same. They have less pulling on them because there's no cable. Mm-hmm. But I've never had that problem. Like I find the Apple ones stay in fine for me. And so for me, they're a perfect fit. And the problem with most Bluetooth headphones is the pairing is a nightmare. Whereas these things can just pair with all your devices and just kind of intelligently switches based on what are you currently using and what's making sound, and it just streams that to them and just kind of works. They're remarkably better than any other Bluetooth headphones I'd used before.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. So they're kind of worth it. They're expensive, but for me, they're actually worth it.
All right. Maybe I'll try this.
I'm terrible for catching the cord of cables on like door handles and stuff, though. Like, I'm particularly bad at that.
Yeah.
So it was a real change for me to not have to have a cable for my headphones, not have them yanked out of my ears multiple times a day on doors and handles and bags. And I'm constantly catching on things.
Yeah, well, that's why I really was more amazed than I expected to be by the existence of wireless headphones, even if they're wired to each other, at least they're not wired to anything else. And the weird experience of, you know, like continuing to listen to my podcast while I try to figure out where the heck I put my phone. You know?
Yeah, I've had that exact experience. I know it's around here somewhere because it's streaming to me. So I'm somewhere within Bluetooth range of this phone.
But so is this the actual thing that we're linking to here? Is this, did they buy Apple ones and then paint them? I think they did.
I think so. Because I think the Apple ones are like $130, and then these are $400. So, my goodness, that is expensive. And since most of the funky paint job on these comes on the little chiclet case they go in, you're never going to really see those. They just pop in your pocket. So really, you're just going to have off-white earbuds that look like Chinese knockoffs. they don't have anything retro about those. So that's the disappointing part. Like, I really do like the retro paint on the little chiclet holder. But maybe if they had just sold that as a skin, here it is, it's a label, stick it on yours, and we're selling it for $35, which would be a huge markup on a skin. That there might be more of a market for that, I think.
Yeah.
But if somebody's got $400 to burn, then they can hook you up.
All right. Cool. And if you don't burn your $400 that way, we can go to eBay. And Carrington, you have the first one.
I have a strange one. It is a supposedly rare official. I don't think either of these terms should actually apply to it, but it's rare and official. Apple computer, Apple Soft 2 source printout from 1983. So basically, that's what you're buying. It is a printout of the Apple Soft floating point basic source code in assembler, just on vintage paper, and no bids, and it's $3, but with expensive shipping for me, $17 shipping, which is crazy. But it's just a whole bunch of pages printed back in 1983, supposedly, of the source code in 6502 assembler. It's an odd thing. I'm like, oh, you're just selling the source code.
That's interesting. Weird.
Isn't it? Like, so I'm like, just, I keep wondering, like, is this a thing? Like, I just, I'm sorely tempted to, like, get this just to have it. Even I'm just going to, like, stick it up. But that's it. And it's labeled as, you know, copyright 1983. But, like, it's just, I think it's just a printout. It's, like just a dump. But written by Microsoft, it says. And, like, here's the source code from 1983 by Microsoft. And adjustments. And it's just $3. And it's sitting in the vintage section of eBay, and I keep watching it, and no one's doing anything about it.
Huh. Yeah, I don't know what to think of this. I mean, like, you know, totally. It might be, I mean, there might be no provenance to this at all. It's just like, you know, somebody printed out a file they found on a BBS or something.
Somebody just disassembled something and just said, there you go.
I think this, so it does look like there are comments in it. So it's not, there's, you know, some non-automatic stuff that happened.
Mm-hmm.
It says, real Apple II, AppleSoft 2 source, converted to EDASM 2 in 1981, resurrected, but not spelled properly, by J. Arkley. and modifications for Lolly by J. R. Houston, August 1983. So the mention of Houston sounds official.
So that's what I mean. Like it's just really interesting thing. And I think you should buy it, Paul. And it's $3.
I wonder, like, if I should. Yeah.
Really, like, for $3? Like, come on.
Well, make an offer.
Buy it. You make an offer, because $3 is not, like, it's just, there's five watchers. So somebody should be swooping in. Somebody eventually is going to bid on this thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's an interesting thing that I found. And I was like, well, that's something you don't see every day.
Yeah.
And the other one I'm picking is Apple magnets from Apple's release of, as Steve Jobs pronounced it, Jaguar. That's macOS 10.2. I guess for part of the promotion or something, you could buy official fridge magnets. And it's kind of weird. They're like peel off, stick on your fridge magnets, includes the Apple logo and a whole bunch of words that kind of have to do with it. It's got an emoji, and it's got the words DVD and email and home and buddy. It's got buddy and like iChat, and you can, like, I guess you're supposed to be able to make sent words out of it, but they're all in like slightly different sizes, slightly different fonts. You couldn't, it's not as good as even just letters for a fridge magnet. It's a particularly useless collection of fridge magnets. There's a question mark, an exclamation mark, like it's the word hot. Like it's weird, but it's an official Apple thing and it's unused. So if you want to stick very strange OS 10.2 based stickers on your fridge, this auction will hook you up for €6. So this is one that you should buy, Jack.
Weird.
I can't even see like a sentence you can make.
Nope. But you can stick the word iPhoto on your fridge and the word go. So go iPhoto in two different fonts. I have no idea why this would be a thing that was even made, but it's an actual Apple thing, and you can have it.
I like that it includes the word switched.
Like, yeah. Oh, right. Okay, right.
It's a very sort of like a lot of action there. Like, there are very few verbs in this at all. Like, sort of making a sentence. There's love.
Got the word surf. That's a verb.
Switched.
Surf. my camera DVD. So I wonder if these are words that were like some marketing company found. Like, what do you associate with the macOS? And these were the top 50 words or something. I don't know. It's just a sheet of very bizarre magnets. Totally.
It's like a weird little word cloud.
Yeah, but don't you think that if Steve Jobs saw this, he would just have an aneurysm. I mean,
what is this? They're all in different, like some are vertical, some are horizontal. They're all over the place, all different fonts. It's just like just somebody threw up a bunch of Jaguar words and said, "There, make some magnets."
Yeah.
And they can be yours.
I am tempted, and the shipping is
see,
not
exactly,
even too bad.
I've got one for both of you. So, Jack, you get the magnets. Paul, you get this official, quote-unquote official, quote-unquote rare, maybe both of those, Applesoft 2 source printout.
Yeah. It's weird and tempting. It's so weird that it's tempting.
Yeah. So those are my choices.
Nice.
Very nice. Jack, what do you have?
So I've got something. I've got an Atari logo trucker hat, and there are, of course, tons of those. There's all kinds of logo hats for every, you know, trucker hats to every kind of logo. But what I liked about this is that it's got the Atari logo with kind of this rainbow effect, which, like, you, I know you guys were not Atari guys, but back in the day, you would see this kind of frequently in games and things where they'd have the boot up screen would have kind of an animated rainbow logo type of thing, because the Atari computers, if you guys don't know, they had 256 colors, guys.
Yeah, I've heard the good news.
And so this rainbow would be the effect to show off all the colors.
That's
in the
like too many colors. I don't think the human eye can see that many colors.
That's true. I think that is true. The human eye can only see a certain number of colors.
Yeah, and two different whites, two different blacks.
Certainly less than 12.
But not all at once. That's crazy talk.
Anyway, it's cool because it has that logo, which is my favorite way of looking at the Atari logo. And also, the hat, brim, and mesh back are pink. Come on.
Yep. The lovely cool. Soft pink. It is kind of cool. Problem is, it's a snapback style. That's the kind where the little snap thing in the back.
Yeah,
that's why
I
it's called snapback. And for us baldies, like that's just like a little D that can burn into the back of my head.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, wear your hat and just have the sun get at that one part. Why? Why would I want that? I would not want that. It's a hat. So I prefer caps that don't have a little burn me hole in the back.
Sure.
Well, maybe can you get two and like wear it, have it like be a in a shirt,
like Sherlock Holmes. It's my deer stalker made of light pink Atari caps. Awesome.
Very nice.
That's what I got. It looks like there are 16 sold and there's just one left.
Ooh, last one.
Last one. I promise I won't buy it, so our listeners will have a chance.
Excellent.
Yep.
They won't have a chance on that Apple source code because I think that's got a day and a half left or something.
Yeah, so it's possible.
You'll have it by then.
Yeah.
It's possible.
There is an interesting aspect of that auction, which I haven't seen much before, although I've seen it a couple times now, which is that it has a starting bid and it also has a best offer. And those, I used to think those are incompatible options.
Oh, in fact, I used to think they were as well. I used to always think it was a buy it now and you can make an offer if you don't want to spend that much.
Right. But you could bid as low as $3. It doesn't say there's a reserve.
Now, often I think the offer goes away, isn't it, once there's a bid? Oh, no, the buy it now goes away once there's a bid.
Yeah. So I wonder what the best offer is, and I wonder what kind of offer they would be willing to accept under
just
$3.
Jump to the end of this. Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's $3.
Because it's not that they started at $1. They started at $3,
which
might be setting an expectation like they're hoping to get $5.
Yeah.
Paul, what is the shipping showing for you for that? Because for me, it's $22.
Yeah.
Oh, ridiculous.
It's 17.
And for me, it's $2.66.
Oh, okay.
So.
That's why Paul's going to buy it.
Yeah. No, right. I mean, I lose more money than that, you know, like on the street. So I think I probably could handle this.
So speaking of buying, Paul, what do you got for us?
All right. So I have. The first one I have, I think the way this, as I've been editing these, I've been noticing that I think I invariably say I have a miscellaneous list of links here. So I have to make sure that I say that. And everyone who has noticed that I always say that can now have drunk.
I love the idea of RCR drinking games.
Right. So the first one is, I thought it was kind of cool. It's a DOS, the new complete reference, by Larson Davis Information Systems. It is a book, you know, a reference book for DOS that is completely on disk, searchable online from 1992. So this is a kind of like an early version of an electronic book which was it came on 4 discs. And I don't know, I just thought it was kind of cool.
What I like about it is it's the new complete reference. So remember that old one that we said was complete? Well, that wasn't really complete. This is the new, like, this one's complete, trust me, right up until the next new, even more complete reference. Like, you're not using complete the way I would use complete.
Right. I don't know. If you look at my, like, documents folders, they always like this, you know, final, complete,
final,
number 2.
0.2. Okay, you know what? I do the exact same thing, so maybe I should just shut my mouth.
But anyway, so online books before there was an internet. Oh, and the next one is...
Wait, I want to mention one thing about this. One thing I love about this DOS new complete reference electronic book on disk is that this product contains a paper book that is the documentation for the electronic book. And this paper book is at least 44 pages long, looking at the table of contents.
Oh, right, and then that's the manual for
that's the manual for how to use the electronic book.
Right. I wonder if that comes as an electronic version.
And what's even cooler is that, like, if you're going to read this, you can't be using your computer for whatever you're reading about, right?
Right.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's great.
Well, it looks like your second thing is sold.
Yeah, right. So, probably.
Did you just buy it?
I did not buy it, although it's not that surprising. I think I'll still mention it. So there was earlier today, because I didn't do this until earlier today, there was an Apple III Plus that was being sold for $400 US, basically, and free shipping. So basically, that was super cheap. Apple III Plus is the Apple III. Itself is relatively rare. The Apple III Plus is the sort of like fixed version that has slightly better video. It has it's a little easier to use the clock. It has a delete key. The Apple III did not have a delete key. They're fairly sought after, but this was they're heavy too. So shipping would have been serious. Oh, and actually, yeah. Looking at the picture, it also seems to be next to a couple of disk drives, but I think the disk drives weren't included. At any rate, I kind of wanted to mention it just to alert people to the existence of the Apple III Plus if they didn't know about it. I think they probably are more reliable, ultimately, because this is the fixed version. The main reason that it didn't succeed beyond that was that the company killed it, not because the machine was bad, but... And this particular one was kind of damaged, and it had.
Was it dropped?
It was. It was rusted. I don't know. Can you rust from dropping? I'm not sure, but droppings maybe. Anyway, if you come across an Apple III Plus, I think they probably usually sell for twice this if you take shipping into account. So. I don't have much more to say about that. It would have been.
So one of the things we should bring up is, like, when I clicked on the link, it just. You know, I hate the fact that eBay now says if something's sold, it's like, well, that listing's no longer available. Check out the similar item. So if I click on that link, it's wanting to show me an HP 9816S vintage computer because, you know, that's the same thing. And you have to click on, like, the word listing to go to the actual listing. So heads up to everybody who looks through all the many links we have in the past. That's now going to be a thing. What a hassle.
Yeah. What I have done... In the previous episode, and what I will probably try to continue to do is basically take the link from that listing. So it includes a couple of tags that tell it not to redirect. So I hope in the future, at least as long as this continues to work, the links in the show notes will now be somewhat more complicated looking, but should at least bring you to ended auctions. So, but yes, it is annoying.
So for me, when I click on the word listing, I still don't even see the listing. I get to a page.
Down.
Oh, is it farther down? Oh, okay, yeah. Got it. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. They're trying very hard to not show you the listing.
Right.
Yeah.
There's
a page, I should think to scroll. We're still gonna hide it.
Yeah. It is annoying. I mean, you know, eBay's not obliged to be an archival site, you know, or anything, but it's
yes they are.
It's still nice to be able to talk about it.
The web should work.
That's right. Anyway, the next thing I have is this one is actually still for sale. It is a Radio Shack TRS-80 IQ Builder cassettes, binder and manual. So I thought this was kind of interesting. I think I thought it was somewhat amusing for a reason I can't quite retrieve. at any rate, if you feel that you need to improve your IQ, here's a 8-cassette program for your TRS-80 Model 1.
Nice.
I think you can probably build your own joke in there. I'd never seen this before, actually. It's kind of an interesting thing. But okay, let's see. The next thing I think is very cool. Carrington, did you just put the same thing up in your own listing?
Okay, you found it. Yeah, I was just stumbled on this thing. I was going to come back and go, have you guys seen this? I'm adding an item. No, I don't need to. Yes, excellent.
Okay. It's very weird, though, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I'm just reading about them now. So go take it away, Paul. Tell our listeners about this very strange Silicon Graphics thing.
Okay, well, it's a briefcase, and it has a look. It looks like a workstation, but it is a briefcase. And so it's...
with a floppy slot.
Yeah, although, I mean, I don't think it's a functional anything. I think
it's just a hole on the side, the size of a floppy. Like, yeah. What, that makes no sense at all.
It's easier to toss a floppy in there without opening it up.
Or have things fall out of your briefcase.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's not actually a hole. Maybe it's just black behind it. We can't see. There's no shot of it open, right? Or no, wait, there is.
There is. I still am not sure. I doubt there's a hole. I don't think there's a hole. But from the outside, it really does look like you could put a floppy in there.
Because I think, yeah, well, it's like it's definitely inset.
Yeah.
So whether it goes all the way through or not, I don't know. But it's really strange. Anyway, it looks like a computer. It's actually a briefcase.
Yeah.
There you go.
And they are basically the same size.
This is one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
Isn't it? Don't you just want to walk around with this thing? If I had a briefcase, I would have this briefcase.
Like, I have never carried a briefcase. I've never wanted to, but now suddenly I do.
Sadly, like, it's got lots of pockets in the side. Like, it looks, I would put an Apple IIc in this or something, and it'd be amazing.
Yeah. It's a, perhaps they know it's amazing because it's an auction.
Yeah.
It's starting at $180, so they're not kidding around. But,
right.
And for some reason, it is $100 to ship to me. So.
Doesn't even ship to me, so.
But,
maybe they bring it to you personally, like they go on a plane and they use like a handcuff.
Yeah,
to the thing, because it's that cool.
But yeah, I've never seen anything like this, and now that I see that it exists, I really kind of want one, and there should be other things like this.
So. Yeah, what other computers would make nice briefcases? Because this absolutely just looks like an SGI Indy. So I wonder what. Like, would an original Apple II, if you, like, just put a hinge on the back and it opens up and go, put a handle on the side?
Yeah, they're pretty big.
Yeah. Maybe a little too big. You need a nice boxy one.
Yeah.
A 3+. Just gut it and stick a handle on it.
Yeah, but of course they have a top, so.
Oh.
They're weird shaped. Anyway, interesting thing.
It's a briefcase.
Yep. Oh. So, nice find, Carrington.
I think a Commodore 64 would be an excellent lunchbox.
Or a telephone.
Right.
Telephone case.
No, just giving a segue for the next item.
Right. I think we've actually seen the next thing I had was it's a rotary. It's like I think it maybe was supposed to be white, but it is now kind of beige yellow, and unevenly. But anyway, it's a rotary telephone that says Commodore on it. And it is in Canada, and it may have started in Canada. Like, this is maybe another of those things that.
It's an NT, Northern Telecom, so that is a big Canadian brand.
Uh-huh.
Lots of NT phones up here still to this day. To this day.
Excellent, but it's just a little kind of ridiculous.
There's nothing about this other than it's got the word Commodore and the logo stuck on the front of it.
Right. No, I mean I'm sure Commodore didn't produce it. They just they may have given these out. I don't even know. Well, okay, so I was going to say they may have given it out, like, with modems or whatever. But, so, point one, the VIC modem that I can remember, it's just like a cartridge or something. Like, it's not an acoustic modem.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'm not sure how that fits in. Point two, at least in the U.S., you leased these things, didn't you?
Right.
Like, the phones were not yours.
Right.
So I don't,
well, you can't be trusted to, like, own a phone. That's crazy talk.
Right.
Who do you think you are?
So I don't know how they would even give these out. Anyway, yeah, I don't know the history of this. 1983. But it is a phone. It is a rotary phone, and it has Commodore on it, so it's a vintage in various ways. Okay. Then the last thing I have is the Ultimate TRS-80 Model 16 bundle. This is pretty cool. It is pretty expensive. It is somebody who kind of knows what it is and has kept, you know, manuals and things together in a nice shape. So it is a starting bid of $1,300. It is in, I don't know where this is, Markham, Ontario. So maybe
just
near
outside
you.
Of Toronto.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's basically attached to Toronto, part of the greater Toronto area.
So, yeah, I mean, like, if you're nearby, so Carrington, perhaps you could go get this without having it be shipped. It is approximately, it's $250 Canadian to ship to me, although I think that's an estimate. You know, the seller says, you know, I'll eat the difference if it's more than that. But anyway, the Model 16 is quite rare. I think it's actually, my recollection from listening to, you know, some podcast or other is that it's actually also a bit hard to maintain. But this is cool. It's got a Model 16 in nice shape, nice big 8-inch drives next to the monitor. It comes with a 12 meg hard drive that has
a key.
Which
is crazy large. That has a key that you can do active and protect it. And I like a thing with a key.
Yep. It has
12 megs is a lot for the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it has a wide line printer. And
I think it has a gorgeous looking printer.
Yeah.
I don't like wide carriage printers that much, but this is a really nice one. Radio Shack made some really nice looking printers at this period. Like that, the mix of grays and blacks in the form factors of their printers at the time. I really like them.
Mm-hmm.
Like most of the stuff that looks like this, probably you pick it up and it weighs like a gram.
Yeah.
They look so heavy and they are so light. Like everything they made. Maybe being a printer, it'll be more substantial, but man, you pick up like a Model 1 or a Coco, it's just going to float away.
Yeah. No, they picked their colors well to make them look more fancy than they are. And actually, I mean, so the Model 16 is a business machine and expensive anyway. All the software comes in these nice little padded binders. You know, it all looks very serious and
the whole system looks like you could book flights. Like in 1982, if you're gonna go out to somebody, they're booking your flight. They're doing it on this.
Yeah,
looks like that kind of computer.
Yep, seems about right.
Yeah.
So it's these are super hard to find. It is priced appropriately. It is basically $2,500 buy it now in Canadian dollars, which
nobody even knows what that's worth.
Yeah, I was gonna say the Canadian dollar's not doing so well. but at least it. I remember the days of parity, but at any rate, it is equivalent to about $1,900 US for buy it now. So, anyway, that's it. I'm through with my list.
Cool.
Done with that list.
Good list.
Thanks. So, I guess we can move on to the closing discussions and anything to add section. I see that nobody has put anything here in the show notes.
Because none of us have a briefcase, and if we did, we would talk about it.
Yeah.
If I had one of those briefcases, I would go on at length about it right now. I want one of those things. No, the only thing that I've got new in my life is Kansas Fest. Oh, and also I'm talking on a new microphone, so hopefully I don't sound too terrible in this show. If I sound terrible, it's not my fault. I plugged in a microphone 30 seconds before we started recording.
Just after updating all the software.
Yep, everything wanted updating. Skype wanted updating. Recorder wanted updating. Plug in a new mic. Yeah, let's see if it works.
It all worked.
Yeah. Sounds fine from here. So.
Yep. I don't really have anything to add except one thing was last week I was in Denmark, took my kids to Legoland, the original Legoland in a town called Billund, which is where the Lego company is founded. And that was cool. Legoland was cool. But even cooler, they have a thing called Lego House in the same town, which is a new thing that just opened last year. And it's much more like a interactive museum sort of about Lego and with Lego, and you build things and play with things, there's all kinds of stuff, and they have like a lot of fan created submissions of different crazy Lego models. And one thing which I took a picture of was there was a pretty nice looking little Lego Apple II, and it looked like an original IBM PC also.
Nice.
Very cool.
I will do something with the pictures, you can see it.
Cool.
Because it was all cool.
Thanks. Did they have anything on the, like a plaque or informational kiosk talking about how to pluralize this word?
The Lego House is devoted to the pluralization of the word Lego. No, it didn't.
Yeah. Okay.
Also, wasn't Lego House one of the elves in Tolkien? Pretty sure. I mean, I know what I'm talking
Lego
about.
Lego Last, Lego House, yeah.
It's all the same thing.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, so let's see. For me, what has happened? I don't know. I sort of feel like I'm still just recovering from coming back from Kansas Fest and having
so
like...
So are you energized? I often leave Kansas Fest energized and with thoughts of projects and retro things I can do. Like I sort of be disappointed in myself for how little I accomplished the year before, how little I did at Kansas Fest, and how little I came prepared to do, but energized and somehow foolishly optimistic about things I can do moving forward. Are you left in the same state?
I think kind of. Unfortunately, I'm about to leave town for a little bit, so I'm not going to be able to like actually implement
going
any of those things.
Lamb.
But yeah, right. I actually came back with my applesauce imager though, so I I've installed it in a drive, and I've imaged a few disks, and I have
making those
great
bottles.
Plans. Yes. So that's that. That's one thing I am quite looking forward to, and I seriously am. Of the mind that I'm going to get the sort of canonical perfect images of the things that I have, and then I'm going to start getting to have fewer things.
Excellent.
So
the eBay listings you pick from now on will be your stuff.
Yeah, perhaps.
I'm good with that.
Actually, perhaps not, but I'm not sure exactly how I'm going to be ridding myself of these things. But
Paul's garage sale giveaway.
Right. it probably won't be just the trash. But yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to, you know, now being able to trust the images that I make of the discs, and I'll scan all the stuff, and at least I will be able to segregate the stuff I have into the things I've finished and the things I have not finished. Right now, everything is in the not finished pile.
I thought I wouldn't want an applesauce, and I have, subsequent to Kansas Fest, changed my mind about that. So luckily there was recently the announcement of like the waiting list is open for the second batch, and I'm going to stick myself on that list.
Mm-hmm. Even, you know, so that it's designed to be able to handle things that are protected in funny ways and stuff, but even for just regular unprotected discs, like from your childhood or whatever, it's quick. I mean, and it just requires a Mac, you know, so you don't need an actual Apple II. You can just plug it into your Mac and yeah. Eventually to your Windows machine, but that's not quite there yet.
Yeah.
So, yeah, right. Exactly.
You said dismissively.
But all right. Anyway. Yeah. So that's, I'm sort of energized. I also feel like there's a huge amount, energized and intimidated a bit by how much I want to do, but all right. I think that's it. Is that it?
That's it.
All right. I didn't let you actually respond, Jack.
No, I'm saying, yeah. All right. That's it. Go.
Hooray.
Go, go, go.
So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, where we will post photos of early PCs and Lego. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, and please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And until next time,
Retro Compute!